Bing bong. I'm back with another edition of the Macro Insights podcast, where I'm switching it up and I'm doing it on the State of Bitcoin feed now. I'm bringing to you a Monday night Twitter space, the Real Estate Corner, where I've got the man, Shane, and Jill, where we riff on the current state of the overall real estate market in the U.S. They've had a breadth of depth of knowledge, and they're just brilliant, have their feet on the ground in a bunch of different markets, and know people all over the world who are very involved in the real estate space. So be sure to check it out and share this one with a friend. If you're looking at this and being like, what the hell is going on? There's some back, there's like maybe 120 something other episodes on another feed called Macro Insights. Why don't you go and check those out? But I'm going to be keeping them here on the State of Bitcoin feed and switching this up a little bit more to bring them all more content. But be sure to hit that subscribe button. Remember that this is not financial advice, and everything you hear in this podcast is strictly the opinion of myself and the other speakers. All right, enough from me. Support the show, hit the subscribe button, buy some merch. Now let's get into the action. Whoosh. How's everything been going for you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. You know, just cruising along, doing the real estate thing, trying to stay on top of all the new NAR stuff that has officially rolled out now as of Saturday. So,
but what are the new NAR stuff?
Oh, it's part of that settlement agreement from the lawsuit about it just changed some paperwork, pretty much is about all it did.
Ah, okay. So it wasn't anything too crazy.
Well, it's got the way that the media portrays it. It kind of depends, but it's the, buyer's agent and real estate compensation commission thing that has been all over for a year or so is now like the part of the settlement agreement is now in place of new way of doing business for NAR.
Gotcha. All right. Well, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, sounds like it's probably just getting a new routine going for some of the paperwork, and then
for
once
sure.
You get that down, it's all good, right?
And trying to communicate with people that, you know, the change and what they see on the media is not, you know, as clear cut as they're making it out to be. That really, it's the same process, just the paperwork's a little different.
Yeah, I mean, it always seems to be that way, right? Media portraying is something to be a little bit more dramatic than it is necessarily.
For sure. I think as Americans, we should go ahead and decide that we're really tired of that.
I agree, but hey, I guess everybody's got a job to do, so unfortunately, they're going to be cranking that up, but then we got Shane in here, so let's get Shane on up here. I know Shane texted me about the real estate market being a traffic jam, so let's get him up here. Shane, I sent you a request to talk if you want to come on up whenever you're ready. I know you were dealing with some oil change stuff.
Did we have an article that we were working off of tonight, Brandon? Do you know?
I don't know if it was an article necessarily. Shane just texted me earlier today, and I haven't been able to really poke around too much there he is. Shane, what's going on, brother?
Not much, man. I guess before we get rocking and rolling, Brandon and I were talking a little bit about there is a Twitter space that either left or is about to leave that we did about 4 or 5 weeks ago where a lot of that, I'll quickly reference some of that tonight, but I'm going to tell you right now, probably like every other theme that I'm working on, this is hyper relevant to people having context and so go back and listen. The other thing is let me see here real quick. I'm going to try to find a note, B. one of the things that we want to do with that one in particular, because I felt like that particular night it rolled out smooth enough, is take some different questions and then throw that on to some podcast stuff that Brandon and I are going to do together. Jill will probably help us a little bit too. But the other piece of the puzzle is I'm going to throw out, there is a very interesting, let's see here, hold up. 1 second. I'm trying to remember the name. Here we go. Okay, John Quigley. And so what we have been referring to sometimes as gridlock in the market right now, off and on over the last probably three-ish years now, depending, sometimes two-ish years, depending on what part of the country you're in, was actually referred to as locked-in effect by a guy named John Quigley. He was at the University of California at Berkeley as an economist in the 1980s, and he identified something called the lock-in effect. Now, I've made reference to this guy before on Brandon's stage and also on other things that I've done. But just to get a little bit of historical context of what was going on, back then, you know, he was talking about how, you know, mortgage rates had spiked from 9% to 18% in 1978. And in 1981, that was leaving millions of households with older mortgages paying what amounted to be below market rates. So buying a new home meant a more expensive loan, adding substantial cost to a powerful, you know, and it a powerful situation, and it was disincentivizing people to move. And so one of the things I think that's interesting is that the lower interest rate situation
Shane, I don't know if it's just me, but I'm losing you, man.
Yeah, I can't. He's cutting out for me too.
Shane, you there?
Brandon, the whole time just recently.
Okay, I just got you now. I heard you up until like the low interest rate environment. So basically at the beginning, I kind of tried to jump in as soon as I noticed.
We got the interest rates changed and people were grizzled, and there was a lockup in the market. That is better. We can hear you now.
JLB, is any better or is it worse?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Can you not hear me?
Okay. So
I don't think you can hear me.
If you kind of go and take a look at the clock effect, it's interesting. And if you study more than what you can just find in the initial article on John Quigley, you know, he gives you a lot of characteristics of what happened when the market is trapped by such a dramatic shift in interest rates. So now that we see, you know, rates coming down a little bit and perhaps even a little bit more on the horizon. I don't think anybody had an accurate crystal ball to that. I just told them that it was, you know, that they were going to go up and that people shouldn't strategically depend upon lower interest rates in their acquisition strategies for investments. But now that we can see that things are coming down a little bit and they're going to probably drop a little bit more, it'll be interesting to see how the market reacts, because there's three things that have happened. Number one, we've lost momentum. Number two, we have markets that are correcting. That need to be correct. Some are working more than they probably should do, but that. So, two. My question is, we just don't have, I don't think, economically, the confidence on the Main Street level, on the blue collar level, and on the working class level that we had before. As far as, you know, there's people have seen a lot of a lot of layoffs. You know, Jill and I were having conversations about the impact of AI on social audio spaces 3-4 years ago. And now the whole world is like, the sky is falling. And I don't think, you know, certain people are saying things about AI where you're like, dude, there's nothing about AI that's going to mess with your job anytime soon. Whereas in other situations, it could be a total takeover of the job, or it could be a situation where they're going to have dramatic, you know, a reduction in force because of the AI situation. So you have this sentiment that has not been ideal for buyer psychology. You have a housing frustration kind of narrative that has been very intense out there, whether it's because they can't afford it or because they were frustrated in trying to buy something. And then you have, you know, correction. So who wants to buy an asset that they feel like is losing value? And in some parts of the country, that's really not an issue. Like, I don't think, I mean, Jill, when you, like, I don't think Joplin and Columbia are really losing value. Has Columbia dropped a little bit? I haven't paid attention to Columbia in a couple months. I just got Jill for that.
No, Columbia hasn't dropped. But again, that's a Midwest college town.
Did you hear that, Jill, or no?
I can hear Jill. I don't know if you can hear her, Shane.
I'm going to leave and come back because it's being all weird. Even when you tried to invite me up earlier, like, I couldn't accept the invitation unless I left. So I'm going to try to go back.
Sounds good.
But no, to answer his question, value has not dropped in Columbia area, but Columbia has some unique factors that insulates it a little bit from market shifts. And that's Columbia in Missouri, until Shane gets back, that is the where the University of Missouri is. And Missouri is one of the states that only has like one large central campus. And so that just gives it a little bit of insulation from market volatility.
Yeah, I'm going to speak to something that I was noticing last year. I haven't been tracking as accurately this year, but, you know, not the way of Joplin is the same way of kind of like Davenport in Iowa or Des Moines or Omaha, Nebraska. And so for those of you that want some kind of a quicker cheat sheet on this, for whatever your reasoning is, like whether you're just curious or you're trying to buy something out of state or buy something in a certain area, go back to the one that we're talking about that we'll probably try to come in here and post next time we come up next Monday, where I go back and I talk quite a bit about, you know, the different trajectories that markets are on. And there was a question that someone asked me that I sent them to Twitter Spaces that I'm going to answer tonight, which was, you know, where is the MSA at? Is it on a slow growth, a no growth? You know, is it a strong growth, a good growth? And the reason I see that is those aren't all identical, but not even 80, almost 90% of the MSAs in a given trajectory, from what I've been able to core sample and kind of take a look at, are actually on a similar path. So what do I mean by that? So if Joplin is kind of a slow growth market, right? If it's not an average growth or a good growth market, most of the other MSAs that are like Joplin are on a slow growth trajectory. So when you talk about this traffic jam, they had increase in price like everybody else, but they didn't have it as dramatically as everybody else. And so, you know, I caught the end of what Jill was saying, and she's going to correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing that, you know, Columbia hasn't really seen aggressive correction because Columbia is kind of an okay growth market. It's trying to make a case over the next 5 or 10 years for kind of becoming a good growth market. I feel like Columbia and Pueblo, Colorado are kind of like the same situation, right? And so I think that one of the things that's interesting in this traffic jam is you need to put the overlay of where the MSA is at and what the growth trajectory of the MSA is for real estate purposes. And a lot of that does sync up with economics. So it's really, really hard to have a strong growth real estate market and not have at least a good growth economic market. They're not always on the same level, but they're, you know, you need one to have the other one be good. You couldn't have like a negative growth market and a really strong economy. I'd say one of the places where that's the most disparity in the country is New York, because New York's real estate market isn't always indicative of how well the economy is doing for New York itself on a regional level. It tends to have a little more disparity because it's unique. But for the most part, most places in the country, that's what you want to be aware of. And one of the things I'll say in the backdrop of all that is, if you're trying to figure out where you're at in that traffic jam, so I was thinking about this earlier, I was creating a little soundbite for a community that Jill and I host and have. If you're trying to create a gauge of where you're at in that traffic jam, you really need to understand first how your MSA is kind of performing against other MSAs. And then you need to understand what vulnerabilities that MSA has in the current economic environment. Do you have unique vulnerabilities economically that someone else doesn't? So if you have a situation where Pueblo, Colorado, and, you know, Columbia are on a similar growth trajectory, does Pueblo have some sort of, you know, unique jobs coming or big jobs lost that are going to hurt it when it's in, you know, where when it's on the same kind of economic real estate trajectory pace that Columbia does? So those are some things that I would really try to dial into for the backdrop of all this is if I'm stuck in this real estate traffic jam, where am I at? Am I at the back of it? Am I in the middle of it? Or I'm in the front of it? Because if I'm in the front of it, and what I mean by that specifically to make it just common sense, is that if the things that have been holding my market back are about to just kind of become unburdened, and so I don't have to deal with a lot of correction from aggressive appreciation during Corona. The interest rates are going to help propel my market forward a little bit. I do have enough of a economic trajectory for my market that I can sustain good momentum. You know, if all those things are happening and you're about to get out of that, then find a way within your burr strategy to double down and kind of hedge into buying a property that you feel like is either at value or under value that's going to go up. And so a good example of this is a lot of people can go a lot farther by buying 10 properties in a period of 10 to 15 years if they can pick the right properties that they can go in and do burr with, right? So just for review, for anybody that doesn't know burr, it's I can buy the property, you know, I can rehab the property, I can rent the property, and then I can refi the property and repeat the process. So there's a difference between me being able to buy that property and pulling that off in 9 to 18 months versus 1.5, 8 to 3 years, because then I'm at the pace of buying a property every like 2 to 4 years instead of being at the pace of buying a property like every 1 to 2 years. Because in burr, you're pulling out that equity that you put into it, plus hopefully any value out that you've got, you know, in the short term being less than 2 years, and you're putting that into the next property, the next deal, or in certain cases, perhaps two properties. So that's what I wanted to kind of go into. Brandon, Jill, any other thoughts on that? Is Jeff here? We need to get Jeff up here. And then if there's any questions or anything like that, but Brandon, if you have some thoughts that you want to, or questions you want, let me go to Jill and then we'll go back to you, brother. Go ahead, Jill.
No, I think those are important points and we talk about them a lot, but understanding where your MSA is in its cycle of economy and real estate and how those two are intertwined is really important. Understanding the why, you know, the why and how did that MSA get to the place that it is in that economic cycle and what's next for them, you know, where are they politically and regulatory wise, what kind of sentiment. And I think one thing that I talk with new investors a lot about is taking a look at, are you in a cycle in your, where you're purchasing of infrastructure building or growth in that, you know, attracting business tax cuts, is that kind of the platform that your city government is on, or are they on a platform of roads and bridges? And that can give you some hints about, you know, kind of what's coming next and how things might shift or not shift over the next 5 years or so.
Yeah, remember this, you know, let's go back to the FIRE acronym, you know, financial position, investment goals, risk tolerance, experience, education. If you're in a really, really strong financial position, okay, and you are dialed into experience and education, you're not going to go into a bad market, but you might be going into a market that's nothing special. But the tax benefits alone of what real estate can do for you are going to force you to make a move in real estate if you're smart and educated and want to be part of that. Like, you don't have to, but if you want those tax benefits that come through real estate, you're going to have to buy real estate. And so market conditions and market opportunity aside, you have motivation to offset the cash that's coming in for whatever reason that you have a strong financial position, whether it's your job is really, really good or employment. You have a strong motivation to do that by using real estate directly or indirectly. And when I mean directly or indirectly, I'm specifically saying either I'm putting this in my name or I'm being part of something like a small real estate investment group or a little REIT, whether it's officially a REIT or something that functions like a REIT, or whether it's officially a syndication or something that functions like a syndication, I have a strong need to put that money in there. That aside, what you want to try to be doing in this traffic jam is asking questions on why the areas that you're going to invest in are going to break loose of the traffic jam faster or are going to be stuck in it. So three things that come to mind that are pretty easy to kind of go out there and kind of take a look at let's just talk facts about population growth. So if I have an area that's like 25-35% Latin, it's facts that Latins are going to have bigger families and stronger population growth than the typical Caucasian family. Now, we could talk about Irish and Catholic and Mormon families and Greek families and Italian families that tend to be a lot bigger than other Caucasian races. But like, I might just dial in and go, okay, socioculturally, there's a lot of Latins, and the trajectory over the next 10 years is going to be more of a growth here than somewhere where only 10 or 15% of the population is Latin. And then the other question becomes, how that Latin population, is it first generation, second generation? You know, how much of it's going to come online to be in a buying position? So you're always navigating two key factors with real estate value, right, for an investor, either the actual net worth piece or the cash flow piece, right? As far as market positive looking forward, we're not going to get into all the deductions and defensive parts of real estate. For me, at the end of the day, the offensive comes down to either the property's going up in value or the cash flow situation is good. And so when I look at something like that, how does that push it forward? Another really good example right now, how susceptible are you or how benefited are you by silver tsunami momentum, right? Some of these things that were giving us a lot of momentum stopped. So if those people that are older that are ready to retire or are retired or want to change your location in retirement, okay, if these new interest rates are going, and the fact that the market slowed down because things were so expensive, right? Here you are, you're looking at a nice house and a nice climate somewhere in Florida for $200,000. You blink, it's 250. You blink again, it's three. And then you turn around and it's sitting at 350, 400 by the time everything's settled out. So that appreciation is, you know, pulled back or it's kind of flattened out. And then all of a sudden, what are the motivations for the silver tsunami? So when I look at someplace like where you're at, Brandon, you know that right down the road, there's a lot of silver tsunami impacted motivation, right? Can you think of places that you go to that you like to eat where at any given time you show up and it's, 50 to 70%, people double your age or 2.5 times your age eating? I mean, shoot, when I was down there all over the place, there was lots and lots of older people. I think that was the biggest difference between going south of Tampa into St. Pete or something versus Denver, was I'd go to these nice hip joints and there'd be 20, 30, 40% of the people younger than me or my age. And there'd be 60, 70, 80% of the people like 10 years to 30 years older than me, So how are those things now that interest rates are loosening up a little bit going to factor into where you're sitting in that traffic jam? You know what I mean? And I would say if I'm in a traffic jam, there's two big questions in a regular car, which is, am I comfortable and do I have enough gas? And so if gas is some sort of economic reference of like, are you able to have the patience to sit tight and not lose money or opportunity? And if comfortable is just, being happy with the risk tolerance factors that you have within the market that you're in or looking at, then that just becomes an interesting situation. Hopefully that all makes sense to some degree. Sorry, guys, a little bit distracted with getting my car here. There was a little bit of mix-up where it was, so I was trying to figure that out. But now I think I'm kind of into the flow of our conversation. But B, what do you think? Jill, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, the age thing is, resonates down here. Definitely in Tampa, you get like a little bit of an older crowd. But I mean, to be honest, since I've moved here maybe like 5 or 6 years ago now at this point, it's been an influx of like younger people kind of moving down here. At least that's what I've noticed. So initially it was, an older population, but I think that's going to play a role in housing. I know we've brought it up a couple times here, but the role or the Florida insurance issue is pretty significant. So I wouldn't be surprised if that, starts to price some people out of things as well. It's also kind of an interesting proposal too. I don't even know if you guys saw Kamala Harris propose like a $6,000 or no, maybe it was like $20,000 helping first-time homebuyers.
I saw 25,000 is what I
saw.
Yeah,
25. That was it. Yeah,
which so. All sounds really good, but it doesn't matter if there aren't houses for those people to buy.
Well, that and, like, where is that 25,000 coming from, right? So, I mean, that's just going to, in my opinion, that's still going to raise, that's going to raise the house prices.
It does. Now, it increases competition. It floods the market with buyers that have extra cash in their pockets. Joplin has just done that with some JHAP funds, and which is was a part of the, you know, municipalities got funds after COVID and they have to use them. And we had some left over in Joplin, and they decided to give new home buyers that qualify 40K toward closing costs and down payments, which just sounds fabulous. And but now there's extreme competition for some certain price level houses. And, you know, the prices are going up because of the demand for the for that kind of income level, that that kind of budget, household budget is one very small, narrow place. So that seeing that happen on a national scale would be ridiculous.
Well, and here's something else about that. So, like, by the way, I don't know who else thinks that Jill's just sitting on a porch in a totally Midwestern part of the country with unsweetened tea and lemonade, but that's what that sounds like in the background. One of the things is that, yeah, the inventory situation. So let's go back to the traffic jam, right? People can be ready to buy, and we can try to assess what kind of buyers are going to buy and what pace they're going to buy at, but the inventory has to roll out. So it's almost like the chicken or the egg right now in every particular market. And I would say that there's just as, you know, the geographical kind of rating or strength of an MSA is important here. But what's even more important is the individual situation. So here's a good example. Let's go back to the silver tsunami and kind of dial into that. And there's so many different ways you guys should be dialing into this if you're trying to get serious about studying, you know, what you're doing with the real estate piece of the puzzle here. What if you have, you know, an absurd amount of people in your target market that are getting ready to retire. And because of the interest rate trap, because of uncertainty with Corona, because of prices going up where they wanted to buy, each year's class, if you will, each year's graduating class that would have bought somewhere else just had a diminishing number. So instead of there being 1,000 people coming out of a particular zip code or MSA to move to Florida or Arizona, let's just say there was only 300. And so now the next year's class, there's 300, the next year's class, there's 300, the next year's class, there's 300. And all of a sudden, at what point in time for all the, for the 700 people a year that would have bought, do we have 2,800 houses on the market in addition to that graduate, to that class's kind of house, right? And so that'll be the other side of this becomes super interesting is if because of other factors in certain parts of the country, it outpaces, even, you know, the supply outpaces demand. And here's the other thing that's interesting about that. When you look at especially negative growth and no growth markets, if that happens, Do those houses take a dramatic hit in value? Because it's only a matter of time in some neighborhoods. This is already happening. It's always happening. It's never not been happening over the last 40 years. Okay, maybe 50, but definitely over the last 35, 40 years, it's always been happening. There's always some neighborhood that's just losing value. Okay, but it's not always noticed because nobody cares about that neighborhood or it's not happening enough at scale. There are negative and no growth markets that their reckoning is coming. And their reckoning in most cases, I would say, is probably 10 to 20 years down the road. But with the right set of circumstances, 10 to 20 years can quickly become 4 to 8 years. And so then you have not only the value of the properties going down, which people buying, I'm sure, are happy about, but the risk that perhaps the whole market or MSA is actually resetting its value downward. And so, look, and I'm not out here on this particular stage, and there's not a lot of us in here anyway right now, you know, preaching that the sky is falling, but I am definitely telling you that the factors are there to have this have an opposite effect in negative growth and no growth cities and any particular neighborhood or zip code that for whatever set of circumstances finds itself beholden to similar factors that a negative or no growth city would have. So
can we layer on top of that, that in 8 to 10 years, the houses that have been put together with shoddy materials by less than skilled subs are going to be probably at their end of life. So even the inventory that you have in your market that is relatively new, there is a really good chance it's fallen apart.
Oh, I'm going to put that a double barrel shotgun and shoot another bullet right next to it, which is, what about the old houses that just haven't? So here's a really good.
Where they're not being maintained. Those are where the black holes are starting, because everybody is pushing out to these prefabbed neighborhoods that are going up in a day, hundreds of houses, and leaving the distressed properties in the black hole. There's a chance that black hole envelops some places that will happen, and I would say closer to 5 than 8.
Look, you've got to create your own kind of customized price per square foot matrix to understand this a little bit better. But I'll try to give you a summarized picture of this. Denver's is an easy example of how they've solved this, right? Because the market has done nothing but go up, 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 up. And as each one of these neighborhoods that have either improved or gentrified have gone up in value, the pace at which they've done it and the demand that has been out there, plus the buyer, have had this healthy formula of being able to keep older houses, because there wasn't as many of them to begin with, updated and in such a way that you just don't have a lot of neighborhoods in Denver that are going to turn into these black holes. Let's go over to Grand Rapids, which has actually had a really good run over the last 10 years. Okay. Grand Rapids had a problem where once upon a time, you're buying a house for $20,000 to $40,000. You're putting $20,000 to $40,000 into it. And then that house is barely worth everything you bought it for and what you have into it. But as an investor, the cash flow is so strong that you don't care. Okay. Then all of a sudden that house that was worth 20 or 40 started becoming worth 50 to 80. And you can still afford to have good money into the property that's older and get decent cash flow, but not as good as the predecessor. But now you have better value, but you don't have good cash flow. I mean, you have good cash flow, but not great cash flow. Well, eventually what happened in Grand Rapids, and Grand Rapids is extremely indicative of a lot of your okay to good growth Midwestern cities across the country, is that once that property became worth like 140 to 200, you couldn't justify putting in $40,000, which it now was 40, you know, what was 20, 10 years ago. Look at all the pricing changes on materials and labor. That's now become 40. And that 40 perhaps wasn't enough anyway, because now it's been 10 more years. So the 40 maybe should have been 50 or 60. Well, Grand Rapids is in an okay place in most of its neighborhoods, but places like the Northwest side and parts of Wyoming are going to struggle a little bit with this. They're going to have issues, and it could be bigger issues depending on how it's handled by local investors and the market conditions. It could be bigger issues than anybody wants to admit. But in other parts that haven't done as well as Grand Rapids, it's going to be rough. And so what if, you know, you're going into that? So I would tell you, whoever you are, if you go back, I don't know, Brandon, maybe it was 2 or 3 episodes ago, we kind of tried to do this like triple bond rating type conversation. You do need to rate that house. You do need to rate all the houses around you. You do need to rate the LTV. You do need to rate the economic trajectory. Am I discouraging you guys from doing real estate? Nope. I just don't want to ever pitch roses, 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 right? I'm never going to be telling you everything about real estate. It's going to be fantastic. Bring us your money. Let us help you. I'm going to tell you that now more than ever, you know, strategic discernment with a very undertone kind of general economic understanding of both where things are at and where you guys are at personally are necessary. You can't just throw out investment capital and typical leverage factors that you could be for and have good results. There, you know, people will come to me and say, I'm thinking about investing somewhere like this. And immediately, if they give me a little bit of a snapshot on their personal position or their personal financial position and their risk tolerance, and if they tell me where that MSA is in a zip code, like I can oftentimes, and Jill can do this pretty good too, and especially in her area and other places, I can within like 20, 30 minutes just tell them it's not going to go well for you, or you're going to be fighting an uphill battle, or you're going to be looking for a needle in a haystack, or you're going to be looking for, you know, a diamond in a rough that might be fake.
I think the needle in the haystack is a really important point, and why we have these conversations are so essential for real estate investors or people who have real estate in their portfolio, is to understand that the narrative of how to win in real estate that has been consistent and existed for what, 10 years, if not 14, it's changing. And so the method, previous win methods in real estate are very risky right now and may or may not pan out. And I think there are a lot of people armed with bad strategies to apply in this market, with the thoughts that they're going to work, you know, things like the 1% rule and the typical burr, like get in, get out in under 6 months. Good luck. That's incredibly hard to find that property right now. Kind of bank on appreciation, have a lot of room for error in your numbers decision-making, because you're going to have the automatic appreciation benefit that's going to boost you even if you make mistakes or if contractors come in over or you take an extra couple of months. It's a win because price is just going up. That's not happening anymore. So some of those strategies of ways to think about how to use real estate as a part of a diversified portfolio have been consistent for 10 years. And I think that a lot of people aren't seeing that is changing.
Absolutely. Brandon, what you thinking?
Yeah. I guess I don't have too much to add to what you guys are saying. With that, I just think, you know, it's going to be an interesting kind of, couple years for real estate. It's going to be something where I haven't really experienced too much, because I've seen the COVID quick down boom and then quick up. And then now it seems like it's going to be a little stagnant. Actually, even seeing like in my market now, you know, my neighbor has been trying to sell his house. I think I've talked about it a couple times here. I flipped it, been trying to sell it for, I think, like over a year at this point. And it's kind of affecting my, the price of my home as well. Mine's a little different. Obviously, it's a duplex and everything else, but that has caused, the Zillow price of my house to fall down a little bit too. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out, especially when interest rates come down. But the expenses surrounding the house are continuing to climb up as well. So, I'm getting some work done and everything like that. But I think that the trades and everything like that are going to continue to be on the rise up. And I think a lot of these houses that are available now that I'm seeing, just from kind of like peeking around, a lot of them still need a good amount of work. I know there's not a lot left on the market, but the ones that I have noticed on are not, seem like they're a little bit overpriced still.
That inventory is sitting everywhere. If it is not truly like in good condition in all ways, that a lot of that inventory is what we're seeing just hang out on the market.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be a trend that continues, because everybody's going to want something almost like move-in ready. Then either they're going to have to drop their price significantly, or we're going to keep seeing like just the crappy homes kind of stay on the market and, people waiting for them to either fix it up or, yeah. So I think that's what I'm kind of noticing play out. Especially in like my neighborhood, and I would consider my neighborhood to be maybe a C+ or B kind of area.
Yeah, I think that let's talk. Like, what are the things that you're looking for? Because Brandon, you say that you don't know. However, you're very stable in the real estate investment portion of your portfolio, knowing that, you know, you have several exit strategies. You do watch the value, but you certainly don't lose until you sell, and you don't have to sell because you have, you know, your financial situation is always monitored and considered as a part of that. So what is it that you're looking for next? Are you still tracking your exit strategies? Have those changed for you? Has your plan changed or your goal changed at all?
Not necessarily. My goal has not changed. Basically the reason I just track everything is just, well, one, I'm curious with my neighbor kind of still having his house on the market. Two, like I'm kind of looking to go full-time entrepreneur, and probably going to happen in the next couple of months. So I kind of want to see basically, you know, one, like where things are at just everywhere. I have like some loans from, you know, paying off, or for like some of the things I needed to fix up the house. But basically, I guess I could talk a little bit about my plan here is to move back to my parents' house for the holidays while I Airbnb out the unit I'm currently living in. And then there's some conferences abroad in January and other things. So once I'll do some traveling in January and then, you know, move back to Tampa in the February time. So I'm kind of just tracking everything to see, you know, how the market's doing, the rent, seeing if I should Airbnb the top unit or just long-term rent it. And I'm kind of leaning towards just like Airbnb-ing everything, because it hasn't really been slowing down for me just yet. And I think if I can continue to just, I guess, ride the Airbnb wave, as long as it'll let me do that, I'll keep doing that. Get that cash flow coming in to pay down the debts and then kind of help live off of that as well.
Excellent. And yeah. I think what we can kind of pull from that up to a bigger perspective is that you are creatively leveraged. So you're using actually your own living arrangement as leverage. You know, your family or ability to be nomadic as leverage, those kinds of things. So you're creatively leveraged, you have multiple exit strategies, and you're in a market that is a growth market. So you know, that is a really strong investment position to be in. And I think that's one that wins here, because I think that previously you just had to, you know, get a hold of a distressed house and be able to fix it up real quick, and then you could sell it and make some money. But now you have to be a little more creative about the things and ways that you leverage and what's being leveraged. Because the real estate market is kind of like a teeter-totter. You know, somebody's going to win. Somebody's going to make money. It won't be the same people that did before in a shifting market. So being able to stay ahead of, like, who has the advantage next and figuring out how to put yourself in that kind of position. And you're definitely doing that with your hack strategies. I think another place that you're in a position to win is if you have a contracting crew and you have access to materials, supplies, and good, fast workers. Those guys have a lot of opportunity, because as that silver tsunami moves out of its houses that haven't been updated since 1982, the person that can do that on a margin and have access to, you know, reduced cost of supplies, as well as, you know, just good, consistent help, that's a great place to be. So, you know, if you have contractor friends, it's a good time to be gathering them up and looking at your market and saying, you know, where are there 80-year-olds that have been in their house for 40 years? Where are there, you know, where are our 75s that have been in the same neighborhood their whole lives?
Well, and one thing I'll say real quick, and then I'm gonna have to pop out, but I could pop back in if I can get this done in 10 minutes, is Brandon, and Jill, you can speak to this knowing my situation and Ashley's situation as well, but you're also speaking to a trend. I mean, we just had a gal, bought a property, lived in the property, and then wanted to move back to Denver, you know, and had some trips coming up, had family. So she did exactly what you're saying about for months. And so in this world of digital nomads, fluid living and nomadic living, you know, I had a guy today for the room, one of my rooms called me and he says, yeah, I've been living out of my van. My van broke down. You know, I've got plenty of money saved up, but I need a place for, you know, 3 or 4 months. And the way I rent one of my houses in Colorado is room by room. And I'm very open to short-term situations. You know, usually I don't want them in there for like 2 months, but if they want to be in there for 3 to 9 months, that's ideal. That's typical. That's my avatar, what I'm going for. And so, you know, it's not, I feel like there are so many things out there that people are trying to predict, like how this will go. And if you would have taken a growth path and said, okay, these kind of kids are coming out of college, they're going to make this amount of money, and they're going to need a house or to rent or to buy or whatever the situation. 20 years ago, there wasn't people at scale living out of their vans. There wasn't people traveling around. There wasn't people that could co-locate and work in other parts of, you know, I've got a lot of good friends in my dance community that can work from anywhere. They travel everywhere and they stay places for weeks at a time because they can work from anywhere. They have to get up at different times and so on and so forth. And so that means they're not using or needing housing. Like I knew a lot of people that their leases were up and they're 3 to 9 months away from signing a new lease because they're going to be doing just what you're talking about, Brandon, for a hot second, you know, couch surfing with friends, traveling a little bit. And there was no need to have 3 or 4 months of rent. So that in and of itself is just one more of those trends that you want to kind of be aware of. But it's interesting. I'll leave this to you two. If anybody has a question or thought for this week or next week, just send it to Twitter. And then the one thing I had someone that had gone to listen to Twitter Spaces, our thing, and said, hey, when you're talking about economic trajectory, are you just talking about in general, or are you talking about real estate? And what I wanted to say, that's for the no growth, slow growth, you know, good growth, strong growth markets. What we're talking about is, yes, it's pretty hard to have a economic trajectory of good growth if you don't have good population growth. But that's not every single piece of the puzzle. It's more just because a particular MSA is doing great economically doesn't mean that all the things that need to be, like let's say that you had an MSA that's just really getting an A rating on how it's doing economically. There may not be all the things in place for it to get the same rating for what it's doing for real estate. It could be a B minus. It would never be a C plus or a C because there's tandem and correlation there. So if a market economically is doing really, really well, the housing market is always being pulled up with it. If a housing market is doing really well, it can pull up the economic situation with it. So you're never going to have a bad, you know, the distance of like, you're not going to have like an A here and a C plus there. So they couldn't have like an A market of really good economy in an MSA and then have like a C plus real estate market. As far as 10 years out, it could be in a bad moment. It could be in a bad year, you know, but as far as, you know, and I'll say that was the other thing I was going to tell someone is that a lot of times I've told you guys before, but I'll tell you again, when I grade out an MSA and I'm getting serious about it, it's 21 or 23 years. So I'm looking at the 10 years behind. I'm looking at the 1 year that we're in. I'm looking at what I think the next 10 years are going to do. And if it's 23, it's because I'm looking at the year before, the year I'm in, and the year after, and then I'm going to the decade after and the decade before. So I want to see what it's done in the last 10 years to give it the momentum and the solvency that give it a better grade or a better opportunity. And then I want to project out, because if you would have come to me and said, hey, give me your forecast for Denver anytime in the last 3 or 5 years, I'd have said, nothing special. Not for the next 10 years, not for the next third to half of the next 10 years is Denver going to do anything special. And I made that very clear on many occasions, and it hasn't done anything special. Like there's certain neighborhoods and certain places that have popped just like they always will. But as a market, it didn't do anything special. Like you missed the best part of the years of appreciation if you didn't get in there at a certain time. And the only exception to that was kind of a false narrative or a false read. Because interest rates went so low, you saw some things go up to 1.2, 1.3 that were at 1 point or 900. And now they just came right back down to that in the last year or 2 years. So, they, you know, if you got lucky in that point in time and sold something, then great. But for a lot of people, they didn't. So anyway, just some thoughts there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an ever-changing landscape. I mean, there's always the you know, the ability to make money with simply just your cell phone now is
is almost endless. So I think there's a lot of possibilities for everything, and that people are starting to realize that dynamic. And because people are just kind of starting to realize that dynamic, I think that the housing dynamic hasn't, or the housing has market has not felt that just yet. And I think that that's coming. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I know we had like the initial COVID bump, where everybody was kind of fleeing the home, and now we're kind of having a slower version back. But what I do think is that COVID created or made a lot of people realize, like, you know, the jobs aren't necessarily the most safe thing that they've been marketed to be. So the, you know, the need and the drive to be an entrepreneur, I think, is still really strong. And I can see, you know, with Airbnb and everything else, that's still becoming a norm, and that kind of continuing to grow for sure.
And I think, no matter what the economy does, no matter what the city does, is understanding where is a problem that needs to be solved. You know, in the whole real estate realm, that is a great place to identify where opportunity is where does the problem exist that's fixable? You know, where can, is it a shortage? Of course, builders have an opportunity. rental shortage, landlords have an opportunity. So just where is the demand, or where is the traffic jam? What's the cause of the traffic jam, and how you get things, how could someone get things moving? I mean, a lot of times that's what investors do with distressed properties, because there is a hurdle here that someone cannot overcome. And if I can solve the problem, then I can benefit from that by being a problem solver.
Yeah, I definitely think that that's going to be a more valuable skill as things go along. The more people that kind of become movers and shakers and have that ability to adapt, the more opportunities those people are going to get. So, that's kind of all I have for today. I know Shane just had to drop. So, Jill, if you've got any other thoughts or anything like that, feel free to hop in. If not, we can wrap it up here.
No, as always, love it, Brandon. You host great spaces. You have one tomorrow night too, right? Are you doing that?
Yep. I will be back Tuesday night, 8 p.m.
Love those. Those are always great discussions. And believe it or not, a lot of it I can apply to, you know, just what's happening in real estate. And so, yeah, that conversation is always a great one. I enjoy it. Appreciate you hosting these rooms.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, thank you so much for coming on in. And see you guys either next week. We do these real estate ones every Monday, or we are out. And I will be here tomorrow night at 8 p.m. as well. So see you guys all in the Twitterverse, and catch you later.